This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. If you were one of the immigrants who came to the U.S. by way of New York at the turn of the last century, you would have gotten off your ship at Ellis Island, been checked for disease, and processed through. Then you would have taken a ferry to New York. That ferry building at Ellis Island fell into disrepair half a century ago, but it has now been restored and reopened for viewing this month. It's part of a series of new renovations on the island that served as the gateway to America for more than 12 million immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. This hour on Word for Word, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy looks to that wave of European immigration for lessons on how the United States should handle the current influx of job seekers from Mexico, Latin America, and elsewhere. Kennedy sees many similarities between immigration then and now, but there are some key differences. David Kennedy says those differences could make it less likely that today's immigrants will be integrated into the broader American culture like the ones who came before them. David Kennedy teaches history at Stanford University. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1999 book, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. Kennedy gave his speech titled, Can the United States Still Afford to Be a Nation of Immigrants? At last year's Aspen Ideas Festival. That's an annual week-long series of lectures and discussions held in Aspen, Colorado. Last year's festival included speakers ranging from Bill Clinton to Katie Couric to Karl Rove. Here then, Stanford University's David Kennedy.
Well, my subject this morning is immigration. I'm tempted to address you the way Franklin D. Roosevelt addressed the gathering of the Daughters of the American Revolution when he began by saying, good morning, my fellow immigrants. We are a nation of immigrants. I've given these remarks the title, Can the United States Still Afford to Be a Nation of Immigrants? The question, of course, has an implicit premise that I will make explicit, that I think not only has this country afforded being a nation of immigrants, but we would not be a nation without immigration. It is of our very essence. Abraham Lincoln recognized this in the proclamation in October of 1864 when he made Thanksgiving an official national holiday. He said, Almighty God has largely augmented our free population by emancipation and by immigration. Now, at that time, there were about 30 million Americans. There was half a continent yet to settle. And it was pretty self-evident why Abraham Lincoln was so pro-immigrant. Today, we are a nation of 300 million people. We live on a continent developed, some would even say overdeveloped, beyond Abraham Lincoln's dreams. And we are experiencing immigration today in our society at a level that Lincoln could scarcely have imagined. There are more than 34 million foreign-born people in the United States today. That, in percentage terms, is about 11% of the population. Proportionately, Lincoln would not have had a problem with this, since in the census of 1860, the census taken in the year he was elected president, about 13% of the population was foreign-born. But the sheer magnitude, the absolute number of immigrants, 34 million people, is more than the entire population of the United States when Lincoln was president. So the question I want to pursue with you here this morning is, does America's historical experience with immigration provide any guidance for our experience today? And the method by which I want to proceed to pursue that question is quite simple. I want to ask two very simple questions twice over. And what I mean is this. The pair of questions is, why did people become immigrants to this society in the historical past? That's question number one. And question number two is, what happened to them and to this society once they arrived? And then I want to ask the same questions again about our present historical circumstance. Why are people becoming immigrants to the United States today in such numbers? And again, what is likely to be the consequence for them and for our society, given the fact of their arrival in such numbers? All right, I want to begin in what might strike you as a somewhat exotic place, and in maybe an exotic voice and a time. The date is July 9th, 1943. The place is Tunisia. And the speaker is that well-known authority on American immigration patterns, General George Patton. The occasion in particular was a pep talk to his troops on the eve of the invasion of Sicily. And here is what this is a printable part of what he said. He said, "When we land, we will meet German and Italian soldiers whom it is our honor and privilege to attack and destroy. Many of you have in your veins German or Italian blood. But remember that these ancestors of yours so loved freedom that they gave up home and country to cross the ocean in search of liberty. The ancestors of the people we shall kill tomorrow lacked the courage to make such a sacrifice and continued as slaves." Now, that is delivered in the trademark patent idiom, to be sure, but it captures in its own peculiar way a very large piece of our mythological conventional wisdom about who all of our immigrant forebears were and why they came here and how it was that they made this the greatest country in history by our own admission. We congratulate ourselves that our immigrant forebears were the most entrepreneurial, freedom-loving, democracy-seeking, risk-taking, energetic people of the old world. We creamed off the cream of the crop, skimmed off the cream of the crop, brought them here, and that's what made the country great. And this is a view of immigration that is deeply embedded in our national mythology. It's what you encounter in most high school and, I dare say, even college textbooks that deal with the immigration phenomenon. And it is, let me underline the obvious, it's an explanation for immigration that rests at its core on a set of presumptions about the character of the individual migrants. Okay, it's a very self-congratulatory and self-comforting kind of a view. All right, listen to another voice, however, that also tries to explain the nature of immigration. The speaker is a man by the name of Edward Ellsworth Ross, who taught briefly at Stanford University, my employer, until he was canned by Stanford's first president, David Starr Jordan, on orders of the widow of the founder of the university, Jane Lathrop Stanford. She did not like Professor Ross's views on the labor question. He thought people had a right to organize in labor unions. His firing actually resulted in the founding of something called the American Association of University Professors and the codification of tenure as we know it. But that's not why he's entering this conversation. All right, here's Edward Ellsworth Ross, a man of otherwise progressive temperament, who in 1910 wrote the following about some people who in that era were known as the new immigrants. They were new, it was thought, because they came from cultural locales in Europe, different from the antecedent wave of immigration, which mostly came from northern Nordic and especially the British Isles part of Europe. The new immigrants came from southern and eastern Europe, from the valleys of the Danube and the Vistula and the Italian peninsula. Here's Edward Ellsworth Ross on those immigrants in 1910. "Behold the new immigrants," he said, "as they walk down the gangplank. They are hirsute, low-browed, big-faced persons of obviously low mentality. They are out of place in black clothes and stiff collar, since clearly they belong in skins in wattled huts at the close of the Great Ice Age." Now, again, just to close the loop, the people he was talking about in 1910, it turns out, were by and large the parents of Patton's troops that he was addressing on the beaches in 1943 in Tunisia. But this view, too, of immigration and the reasons for it and its consequences is bottomed on a set of assumptions about the character of the immigrants. In this view that Ross captures for us so pungently, immigrants are freeloaders and welfare bums. They're parasitic on the energy of all of us who had the good fortune to catch an earlier boat. They're job-stealing, culture-diluting freeloaders and unworthies, okay? They are the kind of people described all too literally, some would have it, in that bit of doggerel that Emma Lazarus caused to be inscribed on the base of the Statue of Liberty, where she talks about, "Give me the wretched refuse of your teeming shore, the human garbage that is somehow showing up on our beaches here in America." All right. Now, I would suggest to you that our national memory and our image and our explanation to ourselves of the character of immigration has very largely oscillated between these two poles of perception. The one, the self-congratulatory, what we'll call for shorthand, the Patton-esque image, that all of our immigrant forebears were the most energetic and democracy-seeking and so on members of their old world societies. And the other, the E.A. Ross view, that immigrants are a bunch of welfare bums and parasites and so on. The thing that both of these explanations have in common is that they fasten on the character of the immigrants themselves as the explanatory mechanism for this great phenomenon. Okay? Now, I want to try to suggest to you a different perspective altogether. And I think I can best begin to suggest it to you if I remind you of something I'm sure you already know, that between 1492 and some date approximately 1820, give or take a decade or so, a period of 3+ centuries, the chief source of immigrants to the New World as a whole was not Europe, it was Africa. Some 10 million Africans come to the New World in those 3 centuries after the discovery. Now, it would make a mockery of our understanding of that mass migration of 10 million people to start describing it in terms of the individual character and individual aspirations of those migrants themselves. Those people were neither freedom-seeking, freedom-loving, opportunity-seeking entrepreneurs, nor were they welfare bums throwing themselves on the tender mercies of the slave system in the New World. So these kinds of explanations for that mass movement of people, we recognize instantly and correctly, are just totally inappropriate. Okay? Now, the point I want to try to suggest to you is that in some proportionate measure, explanations based on notions about the character of the migrants are also pretty inadequate to understanding the movement of 35 million Europeans to the United States in the century, the long century, from roughly 1820 to roughly 1920. To explain that phenomenon on that scale, we have to look to factors other than the character of the individual migrants themselves. Okay. Now, what I want to try to suggest to you is that there are developments within Europe in the 19th century that go a long way toward explaining this phenomenon. And they are factors that are put in motion and work their effect before anybody feels the tug of the American magnet in particular. So the process is driven largely by historical developments within Europe itself to a far greater degree than it is impelled by the attraction of the American destination, okay? Some 75 million people left Europe in the 19th century. About a little fewer than half of them come to the United States. So again, just in the numbers, we recognize immediately that we're in the presence here of some disruptive process that had far more to do with things other than just the United States, that there's something else deeper that's agitating people and making migrants out of them. Okay, so what were those things? The first thing is quite simple. It's easy to understand, so I won't belabor the point. It is quite simply population growth, that the population of Europe more than doubled over the course of the 19th century, even after allowing for the extraction of some 75 million migrants who go elsewhere, not all of them, or even a majority, as it happens, to the United States. Okay, even making those allowances, the population of Europe more than doubles over the course of the 19th century. Without that population growth, that was the necessary precondition for Europe becoming an exporter of people. Without that population growth, which is explicable on grounds that have to do with improvements in the European diet, improvements in public sanitation, public health conditions, and so on, those are the things that drive European population growth in this historical period. Without that happening, Europe would not have been in a position to export 75 million people to other parts of the planet. Okay, so that's a pretty easy one to understand. The second process that is happening in 19th century Europe, we're all familiar with it, but it's an enormously complicated process. We know it by the name of the Industrial Revolution. But the Industrial Revolution has some very, very specific demographic effects. Now, there's a wonderful student of this, a British economic historian. Actually, strictly speaking, I believe he's Welsh. By the name of Brinley Thomas, who's written a book called Migration and Economic Growth. It's about an 800 or 900 page book, dense with statistical data, and I'm going to do you the great favor of summarizing it in a few lapidary sentences without doing any violence whatsoever to the texture and nuance of Professor Thomas's argument. If I were better prepared for this, I would have brought a map of some kind, but I'm going to ask you to imagine behind me here, or in your mind's eye, back of your eyelids, wherever you want to see it, a map of Europe, okay? And in essence, this is what Brinley Thomas does. He draws a timeline across the map of Europe that traces the historical evolution of the Industrial Revolution, okay, chronologically. So it begins in the British Isles with the application of steam power to textile manufacture, and it migrates to the Low Countries, Scandinavia, Germany. Then it progresses to Eastern Europe and finally down into the Balkans and Italy as the 19th century goes on. Okay, so it's not a perfect curve, but you get the general picture, okay, of the progression of this line. All right. And then, this is the second part of the analysis, Brindley Thomas, in essence, does a second thing, which he draws a timeline that traces the evolution of the major sites of emigration to, in this case, to keep the case simple, the United States. Okay. And again, imagine this in your mind's eye on the map that I'm conjuring up here behind me. Lo and behold, the second line is, for all practical purposes, precisely congruent with the first line. And we, again, just a moment's reflection on our own history tells us about the accuracy of this, that the earliest migrants to the United States come from England, the British Isles, followed shortly by the Irish, also from the British Isles, and the Germans, also early Industrial Revolution site. And then later on, as the century progresses, immigrants start to come from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, the so-called new immigrants that so aroused Professor Edward Ellsworth Ross's ire. Okay? Now, Brindley Thomas makes the argument that this is not an accident, that these two lines are, for all practical purposes, just about precisely congruent, that what the process that he traces is the disruptive effects of the Industrial Revolution. As it arrives in any given location, it takes a couple of generations for it to fully work its demographic effects of shifting population from countryside to city and from agricultural to industrial employment. Okay? This is the great demographic disruption that the Industrial Revolution affects. So it greatly catalyzes urbanization. It devalues or makes really untenable many traditional ways of life, especially subsistence agriculture. And it makes, somebody has formulated this nicely, it makes proletarians out of peasants. It transfers people from the countryside to the city, from agricultural to industrial employment. And most of those people who are so disrupted are reabsorbed in the urban industrial sites of their own society. But some are not. And they are the surplus disruptees, if that's a word, affected by the Industrial Revolution in any given place, and they become candidates for migration elsewhere. That's basically the process that is the deepest level of historical explanation we have for this phenomenal movement of 35 million people, about 25 million of whom come in the quarter century or so after about 1885. So this is the real engine that suddenly puts these people in motion is the combination of population explosion and the disruptive effects of the Industrial Revolution. And taken together, the combined effect of these two historical processes is what gives us a pretty adequate explanation for the movement of all those people in that time. All right, that's the first question, historically answered. Why did people become migrants? Let's turn to the second question. What happened once they got here? What happened to them? What happened to this society? Now, I know, as an American historian, the history of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Protective Association, and I know about Chinese exclusion in 1880, and I know about Japanese exclusion in 1907, and I know about the sorry history of the so-called National Origins Act in 1924, and those are important things to be explained as why this society manifested those kinds of nativist and anti-immigrant sentiments. But I don't think that's the core historical question that needs to be understood here. I think the real question that begs for historical analysis is how was it that those 35 million Europeans were absorbed, they're almost all Europeans, a few hundred thousand Asians, but it's almost all Europeans. How was it that that many people, the great bulk of whom arrived within a generation from the 1880s to 1914 or so, they were absorbed into this society relatively peacefully and relatively successfully, that they became part of the fabric of this society. They became people to whose patriotism George Patton could appeal on that beach in Tunisia in 1943. How did that happen? And I don't want to ignore at all the incidences of nativist and anti-immigrant sentiment that we're familiar with. But it seems to me, just maybe it's my cynical appraisal of human nature, that kind of thing is to be expected. But the deeper historical mystery that really begs for some kind of analytical discussion, it seems to me, is how was it that this society managed to take in that many people of different cultural, religious, linguistic backgrounds and so on, and stitch them more or less securely into the fabric of our society? That's the question that needs explaining. Okay. Now, I want to offer three explanations toward an answer that contribute to an answer to that question. How did this society manage this business relatively? Again, I emphasize relatively. Don't want to ignore some of the uglier nativist episodes, but how did this society manage this so relatively successfully? Three considerations. The first has to do simply with numbers. Lots of immigrants came to this country, 35 million, and there are years in the early part of the century when they're arriving at a rate of more than a million persons per year. But the census of 1910, which falls right in the middle, or actually toward the tail end of this great migration, is the census that shows the highest percentage or proportion of immigrants or foreign-born persons ever in the American population. Now, sometimes I ask people to guess what that percentage is, and they know enough about the period, the millions, million immigrants per year arriving and so on. People guess, well, it's 40, 30, 40, 50%. No, it's 14.7% is the proportion of foreign-born people in the United States in the census of 1910, which census records the highest percentage of immigrants ever in American society. Now, that figure, 14.7%, has a property which seems to me is undeniable. It's a reasonably large number, but it is unarguably a minority number or percentage, okay? 14.7%. So among the things that it seems to me enabled this society to absorb so many, such a large absolute number of migrants relatively peacefully, the explanation has to do simply with the pre-existing scale of the society. The immigrants, all of them lumped together, never amounted to more than 14.7% of the total population. So that fact alone helps us understand why immigrants, had they been able to band together into a single political cultural block, would have had a pretty tough time really challenging the existing cultural arrangements that they found. Okay, so that's one. Second level of explanation, I think, quite simply, again, almost intuitively and self-evidently, was the economy. In particular, after recovery from the Depression of the early 1890s, the heaviest immigration occurs, again, not surprisingly at all, through a period of robust economic growth, not merely prosperity, but growth, expansion of the economy, okay? Which meant that, quite simply, newcomers could be accommodated into the extant society without forcing nasty questions of redistribution of a fixed supply of the goods and services and other things that people wanted. So in this, as in so many dimensions of American life for such a long historical period, economic growth has been a kind of preemptive solvent of what otherwise could have been some very, very difficult questions of social contestation and confrontation. Okay, so the relatively small number of immigrants is the first factor. Economic growth through this period is the second factor. And the third that helps us explain the relative success of this society in taking these people on board is what, it's a more complicated measure but or business, but I'll give it the simple name just for purposes of reference. I'm going to call it pluralism. And what I mean by that simply is that this immigrant stream in the late 19th and early 20th century was composed of so many different peoples from so many religious, linguistic, cultural, national, historical backgrounds that they literally could not talk to one another, literally had no language in common, no real deep, meaningful historical experience in common. And what's more, they were not only plural in their cultural composition, you might say, but an associated phenomenon is that they distributed themselves over quite a large area of the United States. The one region that does not receive immigrants in any appreciable numbers is the South. But with that exception, that immigrant stream spread itself over a very large geographical region. Now, there are implications of this. It meant that no particular immigrant group really had a very viable prospect, given its smallness in the general population and its distribution over a broad geographic area, really had no very viable prospect of sustaining its full cultural patrimony for more than maybe a generation or two. There really was no plausible alternative but other than to make its peace with and somehow come to terms with the dominant society in which it found itself. Okay, now it was not for want of trying, and it was not for want of aspiration to preserve the inherited, or you might say imported, cultural patrimony that this happened. And indeed, there is all over the United States today the vestige of one very, very powerful immigrant effort not to conform to the cultural patterns of the society in which these people arrived, and it is the Catholic parochial school system, which is a gigantic testimony to the effort that this, not at that stage of the game, not very affluent immigrant community, was trying to make to preserve an essential part of the patrimony that it brought with it and not assimilate into the religious pattern that they found around them. So that, again, the mythology of every one of our immigrant forebears came down the gangplank and said, I'll never speak another word of Lithuanian again or Italian again or whatever, is a bunch of baloney. That there were strenuous efforts to retain imported cultural forms, but they were all doomed because of the dispersed and fragmented and relatively tiny character of these communities across the country. Now, let me briefly recapitulate what I've tried to say so far. This is the history lesson, which I'm now going to put behind us. What I've tried to say so far is that if we look at that historical phenomenon of immigration, the engines that drive it are population growth in Europe and the disruptive effects of the Industrial Revolution in Europe. If we ask, how did this society manage the absorption of so many people with so little social conflict, relatively speaking, the answers seem to lie in factors like the relative numbers of people that came here, the preemptive solvent, as I've called it, of economic growth, and the plural and distributed character of the immigrant stream.
David Kennedy, professor at Stanford University and winner of the 1999 Pulitzer Prize in History, speaking at last year's Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. Now, back to David Kennedy's speech titled, Can the United States Still Afford to Be a Nation of Immigrants?
All right. Now, having lit this little lantern of history, I want to carry it up to the present moment and see if it sheds any light on the situation today. Now, the first thing to recognize about immigration today, as indeed 100 years ago, is that it is a global phenomenon. It is not an exclusively American phenomenon. The United Nations estimates there are some 200 million people worldwide who are living somewhere other than their country of origin, 34 million of whom, roughly speaking, are in the United States. So the American share of this global phenomenon today is approximately 17%. Okay? So again, we need to deparochialize our thinking about this. This is not an exclusively American issue at all. It's a global phenomenon, as it was then, and so it is today. Now, the biggest apparent, and I underline the word apparent here, the biggest apparent novelty of today's immigration to the United States compared with that of 100 years ago or so has to do with the sources of migrants to the United States today. Here, David Letterman-like, are the top 10 countries that contribute immigrants to the United States today. Okay. Unlike Letterman, I'll do it in descending order and start with the biggest, most obvious one. Mexico is by far the biggest contributor or source of immigrants in the United States today, followed in rank order by China, the Philippines, India, Cuba, Vietnam, El Salvador, Korea, the Dominican Republic, and Canada. Now, as recently as 1970, not all that long ago, the same list looked like this, in rank order. Italy, Germany, Canada, Mexico, the United Kingdom, Poland, the Soviet Union, Cuba, Ireland, and Austria. Now, the present-day list, again, Mexico, China, the Philippines, India, Cuba, Vietnam, El Salvador, Korea, Dominican Republic, and Canada, you will see that list has this unmistakable characteristic. There's no European country on it. So the great historic source of those 35 million migrants, many of our forebears, is no longer really any kind of major contributor. So the sources of immigration seem to have shifted. Just as for Edward Ellsworth Ross's generation, they seem to have shifted within Europe from the north to the south and the east. Okay, but now that we all are sophisticated students of this phenomenon, we understand that these sources of today's immigrants are new only in a strictly geographic sense. That if we understand what has made migrants out of people historically, These sources are not new at all. They are the expected places from which we would anticipate seeing people being put in motion, because all of the places I've just named, for simplicity's sake, let's confine the focus here to Mexico, because it is the first and most important of these countries, and it's typical of the others in many, many ways as well. But Mexico, as the other countries I've just named, has the characteristics of having, for the last two generations or so, experienced phenomenal population growth, and of having entered into, and it's still convulsed by, the relatively early stages of its own industrial revolution. So in many ways, measured against the historical indexes that we think explain these phenomena of migration in general, Mexico is an absolutely textbook case of a country that is in a position, because of its convulsion by these great historical processes of population growth and industrial revolution, to be exporting people, which it is doing. The Mexican population has tripled since 1950. It has doubled since 1970. And let me open another little parenthesis here, just by way of suggesting, in case anyone thinks to the contrary, that we're in the presence of something here that is going to continue to be an issue for a long time to come. In 1950, the population of the United States and the population of all of Latin America taken together were roughly comparable, about 150 million people in the U.S. and about 150 people Latin Americans in 1950. The demographers tell us that by some date in the 2020 or so, the American population has already doubled. We're now at 300 million. We've already doubled from our 1950 base. But within the next decade or so, maybe a little bit more than that, the population of Latin America taken as a whole will be over 1 billion. So that while we have been doubling our population, Latin America has been increasing its population by a factor of about 6. That demographic imbalance is bound to exert, you might say, if you put it this way, great hydraulic pressure on us to receive more migrants from south of the border, not only Mexico, but even deeper down in Latin America. So this is just, on the demographic numbers, an issue that's going to be with us for quite a while. Okay? So the causes of immigration today are really quite familiar historically. And they really don't look substantially different at all in any appreciable way from what we've identified as the principal drivers that put people into motion, made migrants out of them a century and more ago. So in this count, we might say history is comforting to us, or an historical understanding is comforting to us, that we are in the presence of a fairly familiar phenomenon. Okay. However, now, what if we ask our second question again, with regard to the present day? This is where I think the discussion gets more difficult and controversial. What will be the effects on migrants today to this society, and indeed, what will be the effects on our society of receiving migrants in these numbers? Now, I hope you remember, I have particularly fond hope that you remember, since it was only a few minutes ago I was talking about this, that I offered to you three gross historical explanations that went to answering the question how it was that this society absorbed people relatively successfully a century ago. It had to do with the relative numbers of people, it had to do with the economic growth, and it had to do with the plural and distributed character of the immigrant stream. Okay, everybody recollect that? Okay. All right, so why don't we just see if what we come up with if we apply those historical measures to the present day situation. All right, numbers first. The numbers today obviously are absolutely high. As I said at the outset, there are more foreign-born people in the United States today than there were people in the United States of any description when Abraham Lincoln was president. 30 million population in the Civil War era, at least 34 million foreign-born people in the U.S. today. Big numbers, no question. But as a percentage, as a proportion of the total population, here the scale factor I think is again important. The percentage of foreign-born people in the United States today is markedly lower than it was in 1910. In fact, it's lower than it was in 1860. It's about 11%, 11-point-something percent, substantially under the 14.7% percentage proportion in 1910 and a bit below the 13% in 1860. Moreover, here's another perspective on this. If we look at the way which other countries in our own day have taken in immigrants, we also see that for all the high-profile immigration issue has here, There are several other societies that have actually taken in immigrants at a much higher rate than we have in the present day. Canada, for the last 30 years or so, has taken in migrants at the rate of 17 persons per 1,000 resident population per year. Australia has taken in people at the rate of about 15 per 1,000 population per year. The United States has taken in people at the rate of about 3 persons per 1,000 population per year. So measured both against our own historical experience and measured against the experience of other societies contemporaneous with us today, the actual incidence or proportion of immigration is actually kind of modest on these two indexes. So on this count, too, we might think, well, a little historical knowledge here, a little comparative understanding of other societies gives us some comfort that this is, for all the publicity it receives, a fairly manageable issue. Our society has done it before on a larger proportion. Other societies are doing it in larger proportions. So why should this be so challenging? Okay. If we look to the second historical factor that I invoked a bit ago, which has to do with the economy, here the situation gets more complicated. In general, it's intuitive and commonsensical and, like many such things, therefore accurate, that immigration is a function of economic vitality. People flow from areas of economic depression or disruption into areas of economic vitality where they have prospects for employment. However, as the current debate about immigration reminds us in the Congress and elsewhere, people aren't willing to settle for an explanation of immigration on the basis of economic vitality. We start to get into all kinds of argumentation about the economic costs of immigration, the wage-depressive effects of immigration, and maybe even the job-displacement effects of immigration. All right. Here I'm going to go scholarly on you, and I'm going to draw on a very, very dense and I think very good study commissioned by the National Academy of Sciences and done by the National Research Council and published in 1997, a book called The New Americans. And they took on the task, it's a very difficult task as it turns out, methodologically, of trying to come up with some answers to the questions about the economic implications of immigration today. They found that for all the size of the immigrant labor stream, that immigrants added only about 4% to the total labor force in their period of study, which was roughly 1980 to 1995. And they concluded as well, when it came to the wage effects of migration, and I quote them here, that there is a weak relationship between native workers and the number of immigrants in terms of employment compensation. The primary wage depressive effect of immigration, it turns out, is on the immediately prior immigrant wave. Okay? So in essence, it's Mexican teenagers depressing the wage levels of their fathers and uncles, in a sense, who arrived maybe a decade earlier. Okay, but on the economy as a whole, or in the workforce as a whole, the wage depressive effects of immigration were thought, the conclusion of this study is that they were really quite modest indeed. So there's very weak support in this study for the notion that immigration has any appreciable effect on unemployment or on wage depression. The correlation is positive. There is some effect, but it's of a very, very modest sort. Okay. Now, still more technical point. It also comes out of this same finding. These researchers drew a distinction between what they call the economic effects of immigration. Okay, I'll come back to an explanation of that in just a moment. Economic effects of immigration on the one hand and what they called the fiscal effects of immigration on the other. Okay, so you need to keep this distinction in mind. Economic effects and fiscal effects. It turns out the fiscal effects are much easier to track, and I'll come back to that point in a minute, than the economic effects. Okay, the task of assigning a numeric value to the economic effects of immigration, you can imagine if you just think it through for a few seconds, are enormously challenging and complicated. How do you measure the effects on a $13 trillion economy of this mix of peoples coming from elsewhere and contributing to the labor force in the way that they do? Very, very difficult conceptual methodological question. The study took it on, nevertheless, and concluded that the net annual effect of the immigrant presence on these numbers in the present day, the net annual effect was plus $10 billion. Okay? The economy annually was about $10 billion bigger than it would be if, hypothetically, we could extract all these immigrants from the workforce and the society, both as workers and consumers. Okay. $10 billion is a big number. It's one-third of Warren Buffett's fortune. One-seventh of Bill Gates' fortune. You know, it's not a trivial number. But in a $13 trillion economy, it's noise in the system. It's loose change. It wouldn't matter much to our overall understanding of this if the sign were reversed and it was negative $10 billion. It's just not a significant number measured against $13 trillion worth of overall economic activity. So essentially, the study concluded, this is my words, not theirs, is that the overall economic effect of immigration is a wash. It's neither strongly positive nor strongly negative. Okay, it's positive in their conclusion, but not by much. Okay, that's the economic effect, and that's their conclusion. All right. Now, the fiscal effect, and this is where I think a lot of times, in a lot of ways, this is where the real political argument is joined. According to this study, at the federal level, the net effect of immigration, they figured, was somewhere in the range of +$2 to +$4 per year per native-born household. Plus, okay? Because immigrants pay taxes, yes, they do, but whether they're legal or illegal. And they also make some claims on public services, okay? So in the federal tax revenue system, the net effect of immigration is to subsidize, as it were, native-born households at the rate of about $2 to $4 a year. Again, not a very significant effect, okay? However, at the state level, things look quite dramatically different. And in the two states studied, New Jersey and California, let's take New Jersey first, their estimation was that the net price or cost to the average native-born household in the state of New Jersey was negative $232 per year. That it cost native-born households in New Jersey about $232 a year to sustain the immigrant population in that state. And the major sources of expenditure, of course, the obvious ones. It's health care, especially emergency room treatment, and education, schooling. Okay, no question about where the sources are. In California, the study concluded that the net effect on a native-born household in California of the immigrant presence, which is sizable, about 25% of the population of California is foreign-born, that the net effect there in California was negative $1,178 a year. That it cost, round numbers, $1,200 a year for native-born households to sustain the immigrant population in California, just at the fiscal level. Now, this is segregated from overall economic effects. Let's not forget this, okay? Now, that's a pretty substantial number, $1,200 a year per native-born household. And that's the economic reality that underlay Prop 187 in California some years ago, which was an attempt by popular initiative to restrict especially illegal immigrants from access to certain public services, most notably education. A proposal that was, not so incidentally, dead on arrival constitutionally because of that troublesome old poo, the 14th Amendment, which says, quite literally, that no state shall deprive any person, not citizen, but any person in its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. All right, I make this is a pretty elaborate roundabout way of saying simply that the economic argument about immigration, which I pretty grossly simplified when I talked about the historic phenomenon, that is that a robust and growing economy made possible the absorption of lots of newcomers, that argument has become much more complicated in an era in which the apparatus of the welfare state has grown more large. The provision of more education, more expensive education, and health services in particular on the taxpayer's dollar has politicized this phenomenon and revenueized it, again, if that's a word, to a degree that didn't exist a century ago. And that's where a lot of the political argument focuses. And that, the argument is not without a basis in reality. Okay? My own position would be that, in particular, the expenditures for education of immigrant children is not to be regarded simply as a current cost, but as an investment in the future, and as an investment in the skill set of people who will one day enter the workforce. And it seems to me we'd probably prefer them to enter the workforce with some skills than not, so they will be not only contributing members of the society, but or self-sustaining members of the society, but will be eventually, we hope, contribute to its overall wealth and prosperity. All right, let me conclude finally, by visiting the third of our factors that I mentioned earlier that help us understand the relative success of our society in absorbing all these people a century ago. And it has to do with the plural and distributed character of the immigrant stream. The most recent data I have are from 2005. They probably don't look terribly different this year, but in 2005, the Hispanic percentage of the population of the major southwestern states looked like this. New Mexico, 38%. Texas, 25%. Arizona, 19%. Actually, that number is probably a bit bigger because immigration has been funneled into Arizona in recent months and years. Colorado, 13%. I wouldn't be surprised if that one's a little bigger, too. And California, 32%. Now, those numbers tell us something pretty important, that we're in the presence here of an immigrant stream that is concentrating disproportionately in a given region, although it is beginning to spread out elsewhere, and that comes from a single and coherent source, a source that is coherent linguistically, culturally, religiously, and so on. We have no experience, no historic experience that resembles this. We have not been host to any other immigrant group that was as concentrated in a given region, and what's more, has its country of origin easily accessible across a very permeable land border right next door, and a population that is so dense and so concentrated in its own numbers that it has the option or the possibility, and I don't put it any more strongly than that, but it has an opportunity available to it that a lot of other immigrant groups would have liked to have had, and indeed tried to have but couldn't pull off, of maintaining its cultural patrimony and its cultural identity over a lot more than just a one or two generation interval. Now, I'm not predicting that's what's going to happen, but I just say in the structure of things, in the nature of this immigrant group and the way it has settled and where it's located, that it has an option available to it that was not available to any other group with whom we have historical experience. Now, there are some writers, most notably and recently, Samuel P. Huntington, political scientist at Harvard, in a book called Who Are We?, who conjures the image of a kind of Chicano Quebec emerging, particularly in the American Southwest, a region that will have the demographic weight and, if it chooses, the political muscle to insist on a set of cultural arrangements that will be at some odds with the norms in the rest of the society, the way Quebec has insisted for itself in Canada. And even a passing knowledge of the kind of continual perturbations of Canada's social fabric occasioned by the Quebec issue should instruct us that this is probably not a result that we want to encourage, that we're probably going to be happier as a society if we don't have a subset of ourselves that insists on doing business in a different language and according to a different set of cultural norms. So, The emergence of a Chicano Quebec, it seems to me, is something that public policy in this country ought to be oriented toward discouraging, not encouraging. All right. Samuel P. Huntington, in my judgment, just to say it summarily, I think is wildly pessimistic about this matter and alarmist to a degree that the facts don't warrant. It's an issue. I've raised it myself. I raised it in print, as early as 1996. And to be honest, truth in packaging here, Huntington draws on some of my own arguments earlier, but I was simply suggesting this was a possibility. I wasn't predicting that it would be an outcome. And in fact, the Public Policy Institute of California, which is based in San Francisco and is dedicated to studying, it's a kind of a Brookings-style institution dedicated just to matters Californian, recently came up with the following data about the assimilation rates of Mexican migrants in California. And it looks like this. The first generation of Mexican immigrants has in that population, only 4% have college degrees and only 22% have finished high school. That's the immigrating generation, okay? In the next generation, second generation, usually native-born but to immigrant parents, 15% have college degrees and 82% finished high school. Now, that is a quantum leap from the immigrating generation's educational endowment to the first native-born generation educational endowment, and suggests, to me at least, that the traditional forces, market-driven forces of what you need to do to make it in this society are, in fact, working their historic way and assimilating people into our larger cultural patterns, linguistically and educationally and otherwise, in a way that's pretty familiar to us. However, I do think that, to repeat what I said just a moment ago, just the structure, the nature of the, particularly the Mexican immigrant community in this society, raises issues about possible futures that did not exist in any plausible way for other immigrant groups. And it may be not the smartest thing for us to rely on historic patterns of kind of laissez-faire, let immigrant groups do what they will and they'll make their way into the society because they don't have any other choice. That kind of assumption may not be viable going forward. We may need to be smarter and cleverer than our ancestors were in figuring out ways to assimilate or absorb. Assimilate might be a dirty word in some quarters, but absorb new arrivals into this society in a targeted way. So I began with Lincoln. I'll end with him too, because as in so many occasions, he has some words of wisdom for us on this matter. This particular sentence, or two sentences actually, came from his first message to Congress when he was urging the Congress to think about a compensated emancipation scheme as a way of ending slavery and propitiating the South and averting or ending the Civil War. But he said on that occasion, he said, "As our case is new, so must we think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." Thank you.
Stanford University historian David Kennedy speaking last summer at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Kennedy won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1999 book, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. If you missed part of today's speech with David Kennedy, or if you would just like to hear it again, just go to our website. It's wordforword.org. There you can hear this week's show and also subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs. Among them are sessions with historians David McCullough and Doris Kearns Goodwin and Aspen Ideas Festival programs with Bill Clinton and Karl Rove. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And we had help this week from Sam Keenan. American Public Media.